Here we go. You know, Bucky's, Tom, they've been around, but I don't know, like 51 years or something like that. But I don't know, like 16 locations. Bucky's Auto Service Center is the biggest and best in the Northwest when it comes to making sure they take great care of your car. Trust the men and women long before anybody else was wearing rubber gloves, they were. I'm going to try to get Hannah in here and dive in at the exact same time. Ready?
Go.
Did it work? I was underwater. Did it work? Yes, there we go. There she is. Oh, and the cat's there and everything. All right. Hannah, you don't normally cut other animal around the big pond. Yeah, I know. You don't normally cover stories like this, but the next step for the NCAA is the idea that, hey, we have to start paying these guys and gals.
And actually, I have been covering this for several years because there was a bill in the legislature from Drew Stokesbury, Republican, several years ago. Yeah. That actually, a couple of years in a row, he had tried this and failed. And then somehow or another, I got in connected with the lawyer who's behind these suits at the national level. So when yesterday's ruling came down, I immediately called him and said, hey, were you surprised? And he was a little bit, but not entirely. So what we're talking about, of course, is the ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court yesterday in relation to one of his cases. And this has to do with, I'll let him tell you.
It was a challenge to the NCAA rules that limit the amount of compensation that student athletes can be paid. Caps have always been in place. And about 3 or 4 years ago, we started to erode that. So 3 years ago, I got the NCAA to agree that they would pay student athletes the full cost of attendance, which was an increase of about $6,000 a year from what the rules previously allowed. And then I challenged the rules again, and this now says that the NCAA must allow its schools to offer student athletes education-related benefits. So, for example, if they want to pay for a student athlete to go to law school or medical school, and they want to use that as a competitive advantage, they have to be allowed to do that.
And here's the legal argument.
Well, the legal argument is it's not necessary to restrain what athletes get paid in order to preserve the sport for people to like NCAA athletics. And in fact, everyone knows that the schools and the coaches are getting paid, you know, tens of millions of dollars, and new stadiums are being built, and it's a very professional enterprise. So the notion that student athletes can't participate is antiquated and illegal, in my view. The antitrust laws at the heart of this case is that the schools and the conferences have jointly agreed to price fix, and that's illegal under the antitrust laws.
So not only did this go in his favor yesterday, it went big in his favor.
Not only did they agree with me in a 9-0 opinion, which is very rare these days to get a unanimous opinion from this Supreme Court, but Justice Kavanaugh thinks that we haven't gone far enough and that any restriction of any kind on the right of student athletes to get paid is illegal. That is a significant change. And the court suggested even more. So the NCAA had relied on a case for years to fight off all kinds of legal challenges. And the court said that case is not applicable anymore. So going forward, we're going to have much more latitude to attack the NCAA rules.
And here's why that matters.
Right now it's education-based, but I have a pending case which would prohibit the NCAA from preventing students from monetizing their names and images. So, for example, on social media or endorsements, I think this case is going to guarantee that I'm going to win the right for student athletes to monetize their names and likeness. Times are changing, right?
So his plan moving forward?
I'm going to actually move for what's called a preliminary injunction. So by the end of the summer, I'm going to ask the court to rule that the current restrictions are illegal.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So there you go.
So is he the one that he's not arguing before the Supreme Court, is he?
This is his case, yes.
Yes, wow. I didn't realize
Steve, I'm sorry, I didn't say his name. That's Steve Berman with Hagen and Berman, and that's here in Seattle, though I think they have offices everywhere.
Yeah. Okay. So a couple of things. So we talked to Danny about this yesterday, Danny O'Neill, talking about the sports impact. Danny thinks this is the greatest decision ever. And when I raised the issue of could this hurt the product on the field, one of the problems that I have with this system, with this decision, is that I love college sports right now. I love college football. I love college basketball. Could it hurt the competitive aspect of what I love most? And Danny said, heck yes, it can hurt, but Tom, right is right. And I have to agree with him, but
yeah.
I'm wondering if Berman or any of the other people are at all concerned about the huge number of fans that college, you know, sports have, and if this kind of, if college football and college basketball turns into just another pro league, if that actually will hurt the kind of enthusiasm sports fans have, and maybe it won't be as lucrative as they think it will in the future.
And I think what Steve said to me was that and I can't remember the initials, but it's for the other leagues that for some of the smaller, you know, your other sports, not basketball and football and
yeah,
things like that.
Swimming and gymnastics.
Yeah, they did away with their rules last year, and he said the female athletes are like bringing home, doing really well with that, and he thinks that that's going to continue, and it hasn't hurt the competitiveness there at all. The bottom line is, and this has always been, and I'm always with Danny on this as well, because and I think that if you're talking about basketball, baseball, football, these are college kids, a lot of them who maybe want to go pro, who have that risk of getting hurt, and then and then what? Do you know what I mean? So I think it's just fair. And as far as the competitiveness, you know, I'm an NFL girl all the way.
Yeah.
Not so much Dallas Cowboys.
Sports.
Go Cowboys.
Hopefully there's a season this year. Yeah. But I don't feel like there's any loss of the competitiveness in that game. So that's just my personal opinion. But no, I haven't heard that.
But if so, let's say a high school athlete, so all these colleges start to want to recruit that athlete. Does one college offer more money than another college? So then you end up having like the New York Yankees, where the payroll is so high and you've got the team that goes to the World Series and everyone yells, Yankees suck. I mean, is that what you end up with?
I think that there would still be some sort of possible rulemaking or agreement, you know, perhaps a conference that has to come to some decisions where it's not just them kind of unilaterally putting the cap on and making a bunch of money off of these guys.
That's interesting.
But because I think that could be a concern. But also, you know, I heard Steve Berman say there that it is not legal, according to the U.S. Supreme Court, under the antitrust laws, to not allow these schools to use this as a competitive, or the students to use this as a competition. So maybe, but there should be salary caps, I would think.
Yeah, we talked about this with Danny too yesterday. The weird thing is that there are antitrust exemptions for the big sports leagues, the pro leagues. You know, I wonder if this whole thing could crumble.
You never know. You never know. But this has been pushed for a long time, and I do think what Danny said is right. Fair is fair.
Yes,
and then
I
plus
agree.
They have a thing that basketball is looking at the D league. So you don't do college, you don't
they
do
create
pro.
Their own.
You sort of do this sort of thing in between, and you might be working with pro coaches, because really all the college was an opportunity to be seen and to for other, you know, pro teams to see you. Then you to build your Instagram and you build a TikTok audience. So then therefore you have more advertising dollars as you move into the pro leagues. And all it was a platform for you. Because let's face it, you're not really going to school. You're really not getting a degree. It's crap classes, and they're just passing you along so that when you graduate, you're using the school and the school's using you. The agreement was, I'll use the platform. Then when you're one and done, kills coaching, where why bother bringing the person on? It changed the whole dynamic of the thing. I would think probably, round the horn on this, hey, in 10 years from now, college football, will it be the same?
No, sir. I don't think so. Certainly not.
90,000 people show up at LSU on a Saturday afternoon to watch the Tigers?
Maybe, yeah. I think so. I think you still have your fans. I think so. Why is it any different than football?
Well, the thing is, what we don't know is how popular right now. What is the most popular sport outside the pros? It's college baseball, not baseball, basketball, and football. However, if suddenly they just become, if they're like D leagues and G leagues and they end up having the independence, there's not going to be that kind of hometown enthusiasm or home university enthusiasm for it. And so the thing is, sport, I think football is such a great sport. It's going to survive whatever. I'm just thinking that in 10 years, the college connection I have to the Washington Huskies is going to be frittered away through issues like social equity and fairness, which I'm all for. I just think the fan part of me, I think it's going to miss something. That's
okay.
all.
Okay, and then you know what happens? It goes all the way down to high school. So you get some kid.
Well, they can already go straight to the league.
I got it. But you're at high school. You're not really attending the classes because who wants to step in front of this kid who could possibly next year be paid X amount of dollars to play football? So pass him along. Just pass him along. But, and then the kid ends up breaking his ankle or whatever, and then he has no degree. Virtually illiterate, and the society pays for him for the rest of his life.
Just keeping in perspective, though, like 99% of college athletes don't go on to pro careers.
Right, and that's true, yes.
There is a future for amateur sports, even if it's not, there's not much remuneration for it. There is still, competitive value in sports.
And I think, I think that there has to be some sort of structure to whatever ends up becoming the law of the land, if you will, because nobody wants to see the kind of stuff that you're talking about, Tom, where the people who are I'm not a big college sports person. I'm really not. But my goodness, the people who are very passionate and nobody wants to lose that.
Yeah.
And that's, it's one of the bright spots of our world, I think, or our country, seeing the competition between competing schools. And all of that. Yeah. So I think that there's an effort on all levels to make sure that that's sustained.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Very
Anna.
Cool.
You're welcome.
America's team, Hannah's team, the Dallas Cowboys.
Lousy for 20 years and counting.
Ah, I'd love to throw that in there after she hangs up. Raiders, Las Vegas Raiders, have a player who has decided he wants to come out and tell everybody he's gay, and I'm sure most people are going, okay, all right, is that a big deal? Hang on, is that a big deal, Tom?
Yeah, I think it is a big deal. I watch a lot of sports, and they were talking, this came up a few years ago when there was that one Stanford lineman who was criticized. He felt he was being bullied by the some of the offensive linemen who were being real jerks to him. Uh-huh. And there was a lot of discussion about this kind of macho necessity of especially football and especially pro football. And that they did acknowledge among these discussions, they're sure that there are gay players in the NFL, but nobody is, willing to come forth and acknowledge that because there's such a heavy and the discussion among some of the athletes was unnecessary sense of macho in the locker room. The fact that you get one guy, and in fact, this guy who comes out, I don't know if we have some audio.
Here he just
says, I hope
What's
I don't
people?
Have to
I'm
be
Carl Massive. I'm at my house here in Westchester, Pennsylvania.
There you go.
Just want to take a quick moment to say that I'm gay.
Westchester, Pennsylvania. Wow.
I've been meaning to do this for a while now, but I finally feel comfortable enough to get it off my chest. I really have the best life. I got the best family, friends, and job a guy could ask for. I'm a pretty private person, so I hope you guys know that I'm really not doing this for attention. I just think that representation and visibility are so important. I actually hope that one day videos like this and the whole coming out process are just not necessary. But until then, I'm going to do my best and do my part to cultivate a culture that's accepting, that's compassionate, and I'm going to start by donating $100,000 to the Trevor Project. They're an incredible organization. They're the number one suicide prevention service for LGBTQ youth in America, and they're truly doing incredible things, and I'm very excited to be a part of it, to help in any way that I can, and I'm really pumped to see what the future holds.
Yeah,
that may be the only...
Yeah, the idea that the athlete that is gay is effeminate is a strange sort of stereotype.
Yes.
I'm sure if you play football, you're not effeminate. You have to do a tremendous amount of things which are considered to be macho. So this guy comes out. I think most people are going ho-hum. America has gone from in 1997, where I think the total number of Americans, when asked, you know, do you support, you know, how do you have negative or positive feelings about gay people? We were at 52 positive, right? It's now at 72. No other country has moved as much as America has in such a short period of time to basically go, I got no problem with gay people, whatever, right? I mean, so there you go. This guy comes out. This will do great things for his advertising ability. He will be able to, and I'm saying he's doing it for this reason, but he's certainly going to have no trouble cashing the checks. Because in a world where you have to constantly be talking about, you know, those people that are oppressed, like gay people, prove it to me, then he's going to be able to utilize his position in the identity politics world to be able to make some money.
Perhaps. I'm not sure that he's going to cash in on that, but if it raised money for these charities, I think he seems like an earnest guy. It doesn't feel like just a calculated move.
But and you know, I do think gonna
after this
him,
one,
Tom,
we're not going
to
need this.
He'll get a call, right? But he'll get a call to, you know, advertise something. The guy that they got who came out prior to the draft a couple of years ago, drafted in the
Michael
17th
Sands.
Round, ended up being a complete washout. And when people are like, "Yeah, he's going to be a he wasn't that good." I think he tackled Johnny Football once or something in a preseason game, and then he ended up getting cut. But he was really the fact that he was gay and made the thing everybody heralded that as some big deal. This guy's playing for how many years now? For the
5 years.
5 years for the Raiders. So, you know,
and he plays for the Raiders.
Well, Raiders no longer Oakland Raiders, Tom. Come on,
Las Vegas.
That's right. Las Vegas and Westchester, Pennsylvania. You know where that is? It's right down the street from QVC. And I used to live in Westchester. Yes.
Now, is that part of Pennsylvania that is rural and redneck and tough as nails type, or is it more the no?
It used to be a joke. When you go into Westchester, you go in gay, you come out. No, to get into Westchester, you go in high, you come out gay. Those are the two streets. So I don't know if that's still. They're still
saying
that.
And you live there, and so does Carl Nassib, I guess.
Oh, I dated my white witch there, Valerie Champagne. That's when I was living in. In Westchester,
well, no one would question your sexuality then.
No. Who's that guy climbing out of the coffin? Here we go. Keel Mortgage, 1-888-770-KIEL. That's Keel Mortgage, the best in the business. I saw that May record sales houses selling for the most amount of money they've ever sold for. All across the United States, if you happen to be able to get that house of yours, if you're going to stay in the one you're in, why not refinance? Keel Mortgage will save you money every single month. All righty. Let's see. The idea that it's good to keep people in line. There's systems in place, and if everybody just sort of follows along and colors within the lines, we'll be able to get our jobs done. And we've set these systems up because we don't manage for individuals. We manage for systems. We manage for organizations. Organizations are a collective group of people all doing the same thing, paddling the same way, paddling in the same direction, so that we can move from point A to point B and be more profitable than any other business. So everybody get in line, and please sign here, here, and here saying that you've read that email.
Wrong.
Wait a minute. How can that be wrong? Hold on a second. Hey, ignore the man. Keep paddling, everybody.
The buzzword these days, John, come on. Yes. Let's get with the program. It's innovation.
Oh.
There's this fascinating discussion about the role of innovation in business. That the buzzword for the last decade, at least, has been innovation. That the people that can think outside the box are really the people that are going to make you, you know, the best in whatever you do, because they'll approach things from a fresh, original angle, a creative angle. And so we need to get what this brand company calls rare breeds. Uh-huh. We need the people that stick out. We need the people that don't think like everybody else. And the balance in all businesses is businesses tend to like to operate, as you were envisioning earlier, that everybody works along. And the most important thing used to be a culture fit, that you had to fit into the culture. Oh, that person, we'd like to hire Johnny, but Johnny just, he just doesn't fit in with the rest of us. So we will not hire him. Now they realize that if you just go for a culture fit, you're going to be trapped into your own simple way of thinking, the same way of thinking, and that you need these rare breeds, and that's who are the best people to revolutionize your business. And again, everybody goes to this guy, so it's almost unfair because it tips the argument too much in your favor. But they'd say, look at Steve Jobs. Steve Jobs was a pain in the neck. He was a jerk, but yes, he was so innovative. He saw the world like nobody else did, and he was impossible to deal with, and yet Apple exists today, and Steve Jobs' name is in the pantheon of great seers and, you know, visionaries in business because he was so unlike. He didn't play by anybody else's rules. He only played by his own rules. And again, he got fired by his own company that he founded, yeah, mm-hmm, but then he was brought back, and he's seen as a genius. And this article is really all about how do you find those rare breeds and how do you encourage them. Just a couple of quick characteristics. They're often rebellious, audacious, obsessed, hot-blooded, weird, emotional. There are people that could be difficult to get along with, but they are the key to whatever future revolution you are going to be in charge of at your business.
Yes, the black swan. I read Steve Jobs' book and the biography about him. Yeah, he didn't do anything like anybody else did stuff. I mean, where he traveled around and went and studied with Tibetan monks. And I mean, he was just always searching for something else. And whether he was involved in cell phones or whether he was involved in whatever he was involved in, he would have taken that sort of curiosity and the bombasticness and all the other things, hotheadedness and everything else, somewhere else, and then done amazing, innovative things because it was whatever the chemistry that made him the way he was. He got introduced early on into computers when he lived down the street from the guy from Hewlett-Packard where his parents were. So then he started really enjoying, you know, studying of how computers worked, and he built his own. Mm-hmm. And so he was fascinated by that sort of stuff. But that's the case of a lot of people that have moved industries forward. The yes. black swan is the person that comes in and does things differently that changes the entire dynamics of the culture. The culture is one way. You know, it's interesting. You think of something like Pete Carroll with the Seahawks. Mm-hmm. So there's a culture in place, and the culture is evolving for the Seahawks, just using as a team analogy, because they all want to do the same thing, which is to win. So he used to do this thing where he'd get these chip on the shoulder guys, right? You get the guys that seem like they were overlooked by somebody else and they're angry, they got something to prove, right? Mm, so you had that kind of group of people, those sort of misfits that had all that kind of built up anger and passion, and then he could direct it all. And I don't even know if that he's still sort of working in that climate of trying to find the chip on the shoulder thing. Mm-hmm. Maybe that has run its course and I have to find some other different sort of thing. But I've always found, like, the systems that are in place, that's for most people. My brother always said to me, why do you have to be like, not, you don't want to be like most people? What do you make? What makes you think you're so special that the rules don't apply to you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I'm a rare breed.
No, no, no.
Brother.
No, and not
John,
at all.
You told us a story about a boss or a boss's boss that you think kind of figured out the best way to handle.
Oh, yeah, that guy. Yeah, sure. My buddy Dick Mallory. Dick Mallory was the president of Gannett Television. So he had 36 stations under him. And I became very good friends with Dick Mallory, he and his wife, and I would always be talking to him. In fact, I named Rye after Dick Mallory told me, would you please name your son Rye? So I did.
Wow.
When I got a job, and it was with Gannett, but he didn't help me get the job. He says, I'm not doing anything. You get it on your own. But then he called the boss there at Gannett, Hank Yagi, and said, I can tell you how to manage John Curley. Mm-hmm. And Hank Yagi said, oh, okay. He said, just leave him alone. And that was it, and that was the idea. But I just say something. This isn't like I'm better than everybody else. Here's what did the damage to me, Tom. So when I was in fourth grade and I failed twice, and I was now 12 and going back to second grade for reading. So I'm 12 years old and I'm sitting in a desk where I'm sitting there with a bunch of what? 7-year-olds?
Yeah.
So my legs aren't fitting in the desk, and somebody sees me walk down there, and then they come back and tell me. And then I fail a second up, so I fail fourth grade twice. So by the time I'm in eighth grade, I'm 16, and I was told by the system that I was dumb, that I was lazy and careless. So the system had analyzed me and the system had told me what I was. And I thought somewhere along the way, I don't think that's necessarily
then
the
screw
case.
Screw the system. Yeah.
I don't think I'm dumb, lazy, and all these other things that the system was saying. So at that point, when I hit eighth grade, I was like, blank you.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm done. And I'm done with the system. And it was starting at about 16, 17 that I realized, screw all that. And I'm done. And I, you know, here I am 58 years old, and I still don't want any part of the system.
And as this article concludes, because they say there is a double-edged sword. When you hire people like you, perhaps, John, or people that are these rebels, they can create problems because they may drive other people crazy or they may infuriate other people. And so what they suggest is you're the most important ingredient, talent. And then what you need to do is you need to create an HR department. And they mention people from all organizations, people that are like what we used to call have Asperger's or something. They can be brilliant, but they're socially maladroit, that you just need an HR manager who deals individually with all of these misfit toys, and you get the best out of them, and the company profits, and so do the misfit toys.
But you know, hopefully HR's job is to cover the ass of the corporation so the corporation doesn't get served. The HR does not give a flying rat about you as the employee.
Well, if
and
they
that's,
realize...
And that's the reality of HR.
But if HR realizes, or they're told on high, John Curley is the key to our fortunes as a company, then they'll watch out for you and control you and beat you down into submission.
Nothing to do with it. Just avoid it entirely. But just everybody knows HR is not there for you. Come on now. Yeah, for your own protection. All right.
RN.
There we go. You write to us at mynorthwest.com. You can text as well at 989-73. 989-73, State Roofing text line. Come on in, especially if you want to talk about the fact that men are wearing short shorts again, Tom. The short shorts that were big from the 1940s to the 1980s, all up until a guy by the name of Michael Jordan had a pair. Well, he had the good luck shorts, Tom. Do you know the story?
No,
and Michael
I don't think
Jordan
so.
Said when he got hired by the Bulls, he said, listen, I want to wear my North Carolina shorts underneath my other shorts. Can you please make the shorts longer to cover the fact that I'm wearing now two pairs of shorts? Did you know that?
I did not know that.
Yeah.
That seems awfully bulky, unnecessarily bulky. Was he superstitious?
He just liked his North Carolina. But you remember how short those shorts were?
Oh, I know. In fact, what I thought is hilarious about this story is I've watched so much sports talk stuff. They often show pictures of, you know, the superstars in the 70s and the 80s, and they're laughing at how short shorts are.
Yeah.
And now apparently they're all the rage. They're coming back, according to The Guardian, that short shorts. Now, you hang out in gyms much more than I do. Are gyms now where you see these short shorts? Because these stars like Milo Ventimiglia was seen. It's this famous
shot. Is talking about his shorts.
So how surprised were you that a pair of short shorts can create this kind of buzz?
Wow.
You look good, by the way. Nice legs, my friend.
Thank you very much. Thank you. I mean, I swear to God, this is just a guy leaving the gym. I wasn't even thinking about it. So the shorts are normal length. But when I work out, I kind of pull them up just so I can work a little harder. It's even a joke around some of my friends that are inside the gym when I'm there. We all know one another, you know, get under a bar or get on, you know, on a machine or something.
Okay, I'm not going to waste somebody's time with that.
Yeah. But they've replaced abs. Now, I know you're quite proud of your abs, right, John? But now
I've given up on my legs.
Well, you're in trouble because legs are your new abs, according to this.
I try to set the world record for most amount of pull-ups. So I thought, okay, I'm going to let my legs atrophy a little bit. I'm going to get skinny like chicken legs so that I could have less weight to have to lift. So now I'm embarrassed, so I wear long pants to the gym because I'm so embarrassed. My legs are so skinny.
That's hilarious.
Horrible.
In 20 years, you'll be back in vogue then, John. I hope you make it that long.
Yes.
Well, they say, and they're trying to analyze, why is it that suddenly thighs are seen as so sexy? And they said, is it that men are unapologetically sexy again? Because normally men just, you know, go with whatever's conventional. And they say, actually, interview a lot of women who look at these things quite seriously. And they say that it represents soft masculinity. Right now, the dilemma for male sexuality is that it's seen as, you know, in the light of Me Too, it's seen as, it can be seen in such easy negative light that this free sexuality that 60s and 70s unleashed, you know, turned dark, that this is a way to be, sort of make yourself vulnerable, to show off your thighs, not as an empowering kind of thing, but as a, you know, as a vulnerability. And that's why they're so darn popular, especially with women.
Oh,
I don't know if you buy any of that.
No, none of it. Here's what I know. You go down to Palm Springs, and all the gay men down there were all wearing short shorts and never stopped wearing short shorts. You would very infrequently you see a guy who's gay wearing cargo shorts. Cargo shorts and long shorts, just what you did, you imitated somebody else wearing, like, really super-duper long shorts.
True.
Still popular. I think some men are secure enough in their masculinity, they're like, I'm going to wear short shorts, and I don't care if anybody thinks I'm gay. So maybe that comes around again, but, you know, that's...
Now it's straight men, and they show a picture of Elton John in short shorts in 1981. It's no longer strictly related or, you know, kept to the domain of gay men, I guess.
I guess we'll be seeing you in short. Well, when Jacob starts wearing them, then we really have something to talk about. Let's check
in. That's right.
When Tracy the Taylor, men over. In short shorts, good or bad, happy or sad?
No, it doesn't work for me. No.
Thank you.
You're welcome.